It's 12 Enough, Season 8, Episode 7, with your host Jonathan Malone and guest host Michael Strickland.
Hello!
Enough is a podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. Your host, Jonathan Malone, is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Michael Strickland is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Atchison, Kansas, birthplace of Amelia Earhart. This podcast is brought to you by obscure biblical languages, Coptic, Aramaic, Ugaritic, all making Greek and Hebrew look easy, and radical Puritan pietism, reminding you that even telling a joke on Sunday can lead to your damnation. And we're back. I'm here with Michael Strickland. Via the wonders of the interwebs.
Ooh.
Yeah. I want to tell you, Michael, in case you did, that radical Puritan pietism I got because I'm reading a book on Jonathan Edwards, and apparently he thought that telling jokes on Sunday was in poor taste. Laughing on the Sabbath is in poor taste. And I thought, you know what? He wasn't right on everything.
I'm glad you explained that. I thought it was a commentary on me to begin with.
When I think puritanical pietist, right. I think Michael Strickland.
That's right.
So for folks who don't know, Michael Strickland. I'm kind of surprised that you look a lot thinner than when I saw you in Kansas.
What a sweet thing to say.
Yeah.
You look great too.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, man. Michael was sporting this amazing beard and handlebar mustache. And it was like a cross between a hipster and a Greek Orthodox. I'm sure you've already heard that. Yeah.
From you, I know I'll hear everything, Jonathan.
Yeah, well, that's how I roll. But now he's the beard is trimmed.
Yeah,
you look respectable.
Well,
but
let appearances fool you.
Luckily, this podcast is not about looks.
Yeah. I'm doing it wrong. Left the beard on.
You could have totally left the beard on. Yeah.
You told me everybody were going to see me over the radio.
For those who don't know, Michael is blonde hair, blue eyed. Probably about 210 and all muscle. And he's about 5'3".
Mm-hmm.
210
yeah.
And 5'3".
Yeah.
And all muscle.
Originally from Singapore.
But so you're there in Atchison, Kansas. For those who care, you want to give some kind of context of where that is in Kansas?
Yeah, sure. Kansas is that you know, one of those long states in the middle of the country.
Okay.
Been to Kansas. You've probably driven across I-70, which is the longest highway in the United States, I think.
And the most exciting, too.
The Kansas section is longer than all of the other interstates in the country combined. That's how it feels, anyway.
Okay, I was going to say, that can't be right.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like a Time Lord thing. I think the Time Lords constructed I-70, so it's bigger on the road than it is outside.
And I do want to say +3 for Doctor Who reference. Yeah. Nicely done.
Awesome. I still got my bingo card right here in front of me.
So where are you in Kansas?
So anyway, all the way to the right, that would be the east to those who are directionally challenged.
Oh, good. Okay.
Where it borders up against Missouri, there's the Missouri River that runs along part of that border.
Mm-hmm.
And Kansas City is right there. Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas.
Right.
If you follow the river north, about halfway between Kansas City and the northern border of Kansas, you would run into Atchison. So we're almost Missouri.
Is that
I don't know.
Yeah, is that a good thing or a bad thing? We'll leave that as
Yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And I want to say I appreciate you giving us directions by way of the river.
Yes. Well, that's how most people travel these days.
Right.
More efficient, you know.
More, yeah, right. Get on one of the long boats.
That's right.
That's good.
You use your ferocious strength to get around instead of burning those nasty fossil fuels.
Right, because Kansas is all about being green and environmentally sound.
Yes, and all about education and responsible politics and all sorts of other things.
And I think it's important for folks to know that you're not a native of Kansas.
Oh no.
No.
No,
Right.
I'm from Indiana by birth.
And you're proud of that.
Well, I don't know.
Why not? Be proud of Indiana.
It's a place to be.
If you have to be born
If
somewhere,
you have to be
that's a
born
place where you could
somewhere,
be
it's as
born.
good as any. No, I grew up in a teeny little town, so you know, everybody who comes from a small town has one goal when they graduate, and that's to get out of town.
And how many people end up going back to that town?
Most of them, I think.
You
The
might have
pull is strong.
just explained one of the weird Rhode Island phenomenons that I've noticed, that people who are born in Rhode Island can't leave. And if they do, they always end up coming back.
Yeah.
And maybe it's that small town feel that they just,
Maybe. Maybe it works on the state level too.
well, it's a small state.
Yeah, that's
That's
right.
why I made that. So, all right. So small town. Well, it's great to have you on the show. As the show unravels, people will find out why it is that I'm talking to you about the topic I have in mind. But let's not, I don't want to spill those beans yet.
Okay.
You know,
You're
that.
keeping a surprise from me still.
Yeah, you're saying, why is it that you want to talk to me? But why don't we just go ahead and start with our Rylage? As always, I don't say it enough, but Charlie Eastman is responsible for most of the music we hear. And my brother does one of the theme songs on there, but that's.
Are they okay with you mentioning that on the air?
I don't know. That's a great question. I'm like, please, no, don't say it.
Oh, don't.
All right. All right. So
Gotta
he,
ruin
I'll,
my career.
my career. One does database management, the other one's a pastor. I don't think either of them have a career in music. So we're, or even in radio bump music. I mean, if that's a career, I, yeah. Anyway, I'll start.
First?
My Rylage is in liberal and conservative narratives and the way they force issues into certain easy sound bites. The conservatives are easier to make fun of because they are.
Because you're not one.
Now, well, okay. That too. Yeah, actually, like when I was coming up with, like, I know there's a liberal narrative out there somewhere. I just need to find it. But so
I'm just
here's.
completely ignorant that I already possess it.
Oh, ignorance is not a word I'd use to describe myself. Plenty of other things. Don't
Humble
worry.
maybe. Humble
Humble.
maybe, but not ignorant.
Now, let's remember the name of my blog is Theological Snob.
That's right.
So no, there's no humility. But so I heard Ted Cruz on NPR, which was bizarre in itself. I'm like, why is Ted Cruz talking on NPR? But you know, NPR in their constant effort to be somewhat objective or at least inclusive of other points of view, had him on the show to talk about global warming. Did you hear this interview at all? I shouldn't even assume you listen to NPR. Do they get NPR in Kansas?
I get it on a pirated radio station out of North Dakota.
Someone on the top of an oil
That's
rig
right.
is
That's right.
podcasting NPR for the Midwesterns. That's great. That's such a great image. I don't think anyone who listens to NPR would even do the pirating thing. They're like, I don't know, it's illegal.
We could get in trouble for that.
Yeah. There must be another way we can come to some kind of reconciliation with the
That's
power.
right.
Anyway, Ted
It's
Cruz
probably
is on.
the Canadians that are doing it, really. They're always troublemakers.
They are. Canadians are known for their troublemaking, for their anti-establishment.
That explains the A after every segment,
Oh,
too.
that would explain.
I
Just
never
finish
picked
your.
up on that before. I'm just
Yeah,
now connecting the
now you
dots.
know. That's why. That and their maple syrup. Um, Maple syrup is probably the most subversive thing to put on food. Subversive.
Subversive.
It makes everything taste good. All right.
My mashed potatoes later.
Oh, it's so good on cornbread. Yeah, put it on everything. Everything. All right. Let me do my Rileys now, please.
Okay, I'll try to let you go.
I'm angry about something and I want to get it out.
Well, you didn't seem very angry, so I wanted to frustrate you a little bit okay. So you could channel it more.
All right, here it is.
Okay.
Ted Cruz was on NPR talking about global warming. And here's what he said. He said, there has been this conspiracy, and although he didn't use the word conspiracy, so I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, go find the interview if you really care. This conspiracy that of these liberal elites and government and businesses that want to control everything, and they've been spinning this story that the world is getting warmer so that they can bring in more restrictions and more control over the people. And that global warming isn't really happening, and it's all because of this grab or move for power and money. That's where it comes from. And
do you feel differently?
I totally buy what he's saying. I think he's definitely, you know, yeah, I see it very differently. And the interesting thing, I think it was Scott Simon who was doing the interview, or Steven something, someone who was very polite on NPR. And he said, well, what about those who deny the global warming? Isn't that about money? And he said, no, not at all. And the guy had to, you could hear him stifle a chuckle and say, big oil, gasoline, I mean, aren't these big companies? And Cruz just like, just kept plowing through his point. And I think that illustrates that bigger issue I have, is that there's this narrative that Ted Cruz is working out of. And that narrative seems to be that there are people in the government, they want to control individuals' lives. They want to have regulations and restrictions, and they'll do whatever they can to bring on these regulations and restrictions to control their lives. It's all about power and having power. And everything's seen that way. The only liberal one I could come up with was Bernie Sanders, that he has a narrative he's living out of, and that's, you know, the middle class and the lower middle class are being taken for a ride by the elite wealthy, and the economic system in America is broken and unjust. And everything Sanders says like goes back to that.
Mm-hmm.
The difference I see between the two is Sanders doesn't use it as a filter for everything else. Like if someone says, what do you think about what's going on in Syria? He'll say, it's horrible. There's bad things happening, you know, and we need to really be aware of that. But we also need to be aware of what's going on in the United States. He just turns it back. Ted Cruz, what he does is say, all right, let's talk about that thing going on in Syria. It's just another way for government to gain more control over people's lives. He filters it, and the narrative becomes a filter. And the danger in that is that we start to see what we want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And we lose, well, there is no such thing as objectivity. Nobody's objective.
Mm-hmm.
Not even me. I know. We still strive to have some sense of objectivity, or at least to be aware of different ways of viewing things, of different aspects of understanding, you know. Mm-hmm. But if we allow such a focused narrative to become the lens through which we view everything,
mm-hmm.
our reality becomes very small.
Mm-hmm.
That's my Rileage. Small-mindedness narratives.
Yeah.
I'm just noticing the Ted Cruz poster behind you and on your wall.
That one right there?
Yeah, right. Yeah. That one.
See, that middle picture is me shaking his hand.
Yeah. Oh, right. That's what I thought.
Yeah. No, I hear you, and I'm with you.
Yep.
There's a piece of all of this for me where I almost don't care.
Hmm.
What someone like he says or does.
Okay.
Except for the ways that I see it filtering down to the people that I'm engaged with on a regular basis. I mean, you know, this isn't my Rileage for today, but
no, that's okay.
one of the things that bothers me about all of this is the way that the divisions in other areas of life begin infecting, I guess, the spheres that they shouldn't necessarily infect.
Right.
Just this, I mean, what I see really is this complete breakdown when you start not trying to look at other perspectives and not appreciating where people are coming from and such, then it's this is my way, this is the way. And it all it's about is figuring out if someone is with you or against you. And that just keeps driving these wedges. And like you, I see it, presumably like you, I see
Right.
it manifesting itself in churches and religious communities of all sorts and so on and so forth. And nobody seems to be very able to see that.
Right.
I preached a sermon on Revelation on Sunday.
Oh, smart. Great book to preach from.
It
Very
is, it
easygoing.
is, it is. We were looking at Revelation 21 and 22, and I was talking about how really, actually, this was partially inspired by a conversation you had with Michael Mercier.
Oh,
About that, I actually listened to
you
your podcast.
listened to, oh, hooray.
So I was talking about that sort of that fundamental misunderstanding of the direction of God's work,
Right.
and how, heaven isn't the end that God has been building towards.
Right.
God is building towards something here on earth.
Did we say
And
that?
yeah,
Oh, good. Oh, phew. Okay, good.
something like that.
Otherwise, I'd have to go delete that episode right
I mean,
now.
I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth. That's what I'm saying. That's sort of where my sermon was, but I'm
I
trying
like it.
not to make any direct quotes so
Right,
that
right,
nobody
right.
else has to bear the brunt of responsibility for this. But I've had some rather mixed thoughts about that. There are those who really appreciated it because they saw this as being this really hopeful kind of message of what God was doing in this picture of the end and so on and so forth. And
Right.
there were some others that simply because I described heaven in a different way, like they couldn't go there. That they had always been taught that we're all going to end up in heaven. And that's what it's about, but that's not what we read in Revelation 21 and 22. But then again, why should we let the Bible get in the way of our theology?
So yeah, that's the first problem is letting that Bible thing dictate. If you just reread Hal Lindsey, Lay Great Planet Earth, you would have all the answers you need. But no, I agree. I mean, there's these narratives that are fed to us, and yeah, and we allow them to feed. I'll say something like after a yet another mass shooting, I'll say we've got to pray for peace. We need to have this stop. And someone will, after the service, will say, "Why are you against the Second Amendment?" It's like, I didn't have anything to say about the Second Amendment. I just don't want people to be killing each other anymore. And that's, and again, it's that narrative that I've got to be aware if anyone says anything about guns that isn't pro, they must be against. And
Yeah, all this is just so volatile, I part of my background, which your viewers, I'm going to call them viewers the whole episode.
Good. Yeah, your view are my yeah, the
Your
viewers.
viewers, of course, don't know, but some of my history involves passing through the Southern Baptist Convention,
Right.
and I've become rather well versed at sort of avoiding some of those buzzwords that you've got to use,
Right.
which which are used in the fundamentalism of the Southern Baptist Convention to filter through about whether you are in or whether you are out, whether you are right or whether you are wrong. I'm okay avoiding those buzzwords, but
Right.
gotten to be where politics and culture have become so polarized now, where there's this whole other set of buzzwords that I don't necessarily have, I can't avoid all of them, I guess.
Right. I'm still.
And if I want to say something substantial or of any substance, how do I do that without using these sets of words that just set people off? It's
Right.
a minefield.
It's horrible. I still assume that everyone is either a Cappadocian or they're modalist when it comes to the Trinity. That's the lens I still live with. And if someone says anything that's slightly about God as the Father. I'm like, oh, modalist, heretic.
Modalist.
Heretic, heretic.
Yeah.
I mean, I my point is, I do it as well. So
old
people,
Jonathan.
Yeah, we all have lenses. We all have experiences that shape who we are, that feed our, how
right.
we see reality, and that's normal. That's fine. But I think it is really important for us to own them, to name them, and say, this is where I come from. These are my proclivities, that kind of thing.
Right. I read an interesting article the other day where it was the results of some sort of study that was done,
mm-hmm.
and they showed people pictures of shapes, like circles, but it wasn't a perfect circle. It was kind of like a circle a little kid might draw.
Okay.
Ask people, is this a circle? Yes or no? And they'd show them one that was like a square, but it wasn't right for a square. It was kind of off, Is this a square? Yes or no? And what they found is that people who answered no tended to also have a more conservative fundamentalist bent in their politics and their religion. That there was actually sort of this incapacity or intolerance of variation.
Yeah.
And it wasn't absolutely right that that it wasn't that thing. And I found that very interesting that this way of thinking even interferes with our sense of spatial awareness, among other things. And, many people say, and I do, that things are connected. A lot of things are connected that we don't necessarily know are connected. But something like that really makes me, how deep does all this stuff go?
If you can't even have grace when looking at geometric shapes.
Right, that's right.
That's.
What are you doing to the Jane who sits in the pew in front of you?
Yeah,
you
poor
know?
Jane. Yeah. Everyone needs to back off, Jane.
Seriously.
Give her some space.
She's doing her best.
She really is. She really. But honestly, she could lay off the drinking a little bit.
Oh.
All right. So, Michael, what are you riled about?
Podcasts. No.
How dare you?
No, I'm gonna take this opportunity.
Okay.
Knowing your vast viewership,
more than you think,
and do a public service, Rylage.
Good.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's totally fine. I don't have to. I mean, I could edit it out if I didn't like it.
Yeah. Preachers. I'm going to speak directly to them. Is that okay too?
Yeah, we got some of them.
Okay. Well, preachers. Stop referring to the Greek and Hebrew in your sermons.
Wow.
Yeah, I said it.
Now
I've been looking for a platform to say it for a long time.
You've been so unpack that a little bit. What's your
unpack
problem?
That a little? Well, not saying that I'm better than anyone.
No, say it.
But I am on Skype with a Theo Snobs.
That's,
so
well, that gives you credentials, right?
That
there.
Gives me some credentials, I suppose. I have studied the languages of the Bible at length for many years at several institutions.
You probably have looked at all those languages that our sponsor mentioned.
Oh, yeah. Did some teaching, tutored, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I'm absolutely appalled when I sit in the pew somewhere and the priest makes a reference to the Greek and Hebrew. And most of them, and I've actually gone up to some afterwards because I'm so anal about this kind of thing, but most of them have had maybe a year of Greek and a year of Hebrew in seminary, if that much.
Right.
And I want you to try to utilize those resources in what you're doing, but you wield those words like trump cards. Because very few, if anyone, in your pews are going to be able to argue or evaluate the data you're giving them.
Interesting.
And so what you're really doing is you're bludgeoning them with your interpretation of a word in a way that they can't respond to it. They either have to accept it because you said it, and after all, it's in the original languages, so that means that baby Jesus spoke it, or else they have to decide that you are completely and utterly wrong about this and probably about everything else. They'll probably assume that you're just this pompous snob like that one guy who does a podcast, and that they're not really going to want to listen to you anymore.
I just established that right off with my congregation. So, yeah. So I'm good. So that's an interesting... I like that take that it could be seen as a rhetorical ploy that puts you in a place of authority that's almost unfair.
I don't think it's intended that way by the preachers who do it. I think they are trying to lend some authority to what they're saying, which is why they're making those references. But unless you're in a context where there are a number of people who are there who have the ability to use those resources as well, all you're doing is playing a trump card that nobody else can top. And that's not, I think, helping anyone, because you're not giving them the tools to do the interpretation. You're not showing them how it's supposed to work. You're not giving them a piece that they can actually use in their life other than to say, Pastor so-and-so said. And that's not going to do anything other than advance a certain set of narratives, which may not be helpful in different realms of their life.
All right. So I mean, that's a great point, and I have a lot of thoughts. But let's start with this.
How many times did you reference Greek and Hebrew on your sermon on Sunday?
Well, I didn't. I...
Are you feeling the conviction of the Holy Spirit?
I was
to pray together.
And, well, what understanding of the Holy Spirit? Paraclete or noumena? Because it's a difference.
Let's talk about that's another podcast.
Right. But let's start with, you know, what would you, how would you say, or what would you suggest is a good way to use? I mean, I would think it's important for the pastor when preparing for his or her sermon. Mm-hmm. To have at least some awareness
of course,
the Greek and Hebrew.
Of course.
So how would
if you've got those resources available to you, I think it's irresponsible to not try to utilize them.
Okay.
And if you've got some level of training, especially with languages, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it.
Right.
And so if you're not trying to continue to utilize it on some level, at least, then you're going to get to a place down the road and you're going to think, gee, I used to know that, but I have no idea what this means anymore.
Which, by the way, I think would be a great bumper sticker. Greek, biblical languages, if you don't use them, you're going to lose them. I can see that going nationwide. Anyway.
Yeah. Get your marketing department on that.
Yeah, I'll get them on them. I'm going to make t-shirts. for all those seminary students who are being forced to take Greek and Hebrew, which is not many anymore.
No.
Unfortunately.
Sadly. Well, I do think the languages are important, and I think a preacher ought to have at least some level of knowledge about how it works.
Yeah.
I found for myself, and I found with students as well, that there are things about the Bible that you can only appreciate when you do some language work like that as well. So I think in terms of having a healthy understanding of the Bible, that's an incredibly important piece. Right. So that's part of why I lament that seminaries aren't doing that. But again, as someone who tutored an awful lot of students in both Greek and Hebrew, I know that it doesn't come easy to many students.
Right.
I know that students that tend to do well in one really seem to struggle with the other. And that those who can do both and do both well are very few and far between. But that doesn't mean that you can't take what you had and build on it in some way.
I had a professor in seminary who a New Testament professor who said, you know, you don't have to tell everybody the ingredients you put in the cake.
That's right.
But you still put the right ingredients in the cake. So you do the language work, and you let that influence your exegesis and your, you know, influence the sermon.
A good preacher doesn't use every idea that they had.
Oh, right.
Every single sermon. And I think one of the ways you can spot a novice preacher pretty easily is that they try to pack it all in.
Right, yeah.
They do too much. They try to say everything.
Right.
You know, do the work. You just don't have to say the Greek word is blah-de-blah.
Right.
Here's what it means, and here's what such and such a lexicon says, and so on and so forth. You know, you start doing that kind of thing, and I mean, if they're listening, glazing over, again, you're beating them with it, and they can't do anything with it but accept it.
So yeah, and I had someone tell me, said never say what the Greek word is. I think there's, or the Hebrew word. I think there are times when it can work if it's part of an illustration.
Well, no, I think you can say, you know, this word means this.
Right.
Or you know, let's unpack this word a little bit. And
right.
it brings in connotations of this and this and this. You can do that
yeah.
without actually saying Greek or Hebrew or Aramaic
right,
or
right. Okay,
the
yeah.
word itself or any grammatical terms or anything like that.
So
that's actually providing some resources that they can take. And, you know, if they're reading in Matthew and you unpack a certain word, well, when they come across that word and they're reading another time, they think, oh, this is a place it might have those kinds of connotations too.
Right.
And it can be an enriching and beneficial
right.
thing for them.
So it's, I mean, I think it's a question of why are you inserting that part into your sermon? Is it to show off? Because it might be. Is it to, you know, for credentials, say like, look at, I'm educated, I'm learning. So here's my proof.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think that's important to ask yourself.
I think a piece of it too, and this is something I can confess that I struggle with because I'm not as much of a snob as you are.
Well, you'll get there.
Yeah, catch up eventually. No, I forgot what I was saying. My insult Jonathan took over the rest of my brain for a
see?
Second.
See? You see?
Yeah.
That's what
Shame
you get.
On me. Shame
that's
on
what,
me.
That's what you get. Well, we were talking about, you know, whether or not you use it, you're using it to
oh, yes, yes, yes.
show how smart you are.
I can confess that I struggle with exactly what I'm talking about. Of course, I'm usually preaching it myself first and foremost anyway.
Right, right,
but
right, yeah.
For me, it has something to do with sort of the native way I speak and the native way I think, and I don't always translate that into the native way my congregation hears.
Oh, good.
So I think for the preacher who maybe does have a greater level of ability and training in the languages, including that might just be, this is the way I make an argument because
right.
I'm citing my sources and I'm used to a more academic way of doing it. I'm an INTJ, and so, you know,
right.
dotting I's and crossing my T's and footnoting everything and all that, you know,
yep.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
That's my natural way of doing it. But when I do that in a sermon, I'm using my native language, so to speak, which isn't my audience's native
right.
language to hear. But once again, I think this is a minority of cases because I think most of the preachers who do this have had maybe 2 years combined tops of the foreign languages.
Right.
And for many of them, that was, you know, a decade or more ago. And, you know, it's not that they...
Well,
that's the
so,
native language. They're using it, again, as a tool of authority.
So perhaps a similar comparison would be to quote theologians.
It could be. If you were a theology snob, that
right.
could be a way to do it.
And you could do it in a very – you could say, well, we all – you know, as we know, Schleiermacher made the similar point in da-da-da-da-da, speeches against discourses of religion, da-da-da-da-da, right? And now everyone's like asleep.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is – It's an interesting exercise to take. Pastors do this. Take the sermon you preached last week, right? Take one paragraph from the sermon, write it out as academically as you can, footnote it, make it, you know, really get to the point, and then write it out as a sermon, and compare the two. Because there's one thing to say, you know, Schleiermacher said, blah, 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 blah. Another is like there's this one thinker, you know. Who lived, you know, in the last century or the century before, who made this point. And the point was, you know, Schleiermacher, who made this point. And the point is this,
mm-hmm.
you know, or as Karl Barth has been known to have said, or Karl Barth rails against this idea that, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, so,
right, right.
you know, to translate in a different way.
I have a friend who's a theology buff. I won't
yeah.
call him a snob.
Okay.
It may be the case too.
It's not easy to get to that standard.
Yeah, he's a theology buff. He absolutely loves it. Does, you know, reads people with harder names to say than Acheson all the time, just like you do. And he's a pastor. And every week, as he develops his manuscript, he gets to a point, sort of after it's written and before it's rehearsed,
mm-hmm.
where he gives it to his church secretary,
oh.
and he says, "Circle every word that you don't know." Underline every sentence that you don't understand.
Oh, that's very smart.
And then he takes that back, and she basically filters his academic thinking out for him.
Right, right.
So that when he really is delivering his manuscript, he's using much more of the language of the people.
That's very smart. Wow.
Yeah. I'm just not disciplined enough to do it yet.
Yeah, I'm not. All right, so this is a good Rylage. Folks, first, know your narratives. Be clear about who you are, where you're coming from, and then be willing to let them be porous, I guess.
Porous.
Porous, or to bend or fold or, push back on them. There we go. Second, pastors, you don't have to show off how much you know. Okay? We all get it. You went to the University of Chicago. You're a big deal. But the people just need Jesus. On the other hand, don't be an idiot. Preach a good sermon. Make sure there's some good ingredients in that sermon because people need to be fed good food. Right, so we are going to go right to the what happened was Michael and I closed our Bibles, we closed our eyes, we opened them up, and we're in different states, different
Yeah.
time zones, and both of our fingers fell on Nehemiah 8:8.
Holy Spirit,
The Holy
baby.
Spirit, clearly, God wants us to look at Nehemiah. So for those who don't know, Nehemiah is in the Hebrew Scripture, the Old Testament. It is right after Ezra. And before what? What comes after Nehemiah? Oh, Job. You didn't know Esther. You didn't know that off the top of your head?
What it comes after depends on which canon you are reading out of.
Out of the Christian canon. All right, yeah. So Michael is using the. So no, that's actually a good point to make.
Yeah.
I shouldn't groan. Why?
Aha.
I apologize to all my Jewish listeners out there.
You and your oversimplifications are ruining American Christianity.
I'm a horrible person. What can I say? If everyone just read their theology rather than the Bible, we'd be better off anyways. The problem is I don't know who I would recommend. So yeah, in the Hebrew canon, where is it? Where does Nehemiah fall?
Nehemiah falls quite near the end.
Okay.
It is after Ezra.
Oh, good.
It
It is
actually
still.
comes right before Chronicles, and First and Second Chronicles are the last two books of the Hebrew canon.
Oh, well, that's a happy way to end.
Yeah.
Where's Esther in all that?
Oh, Esther's earlier.
Okay, that's all you need to say. You don't have to.
Yeah.
I don't want to make you work for
If
it.
I remember right, it's part of the Megillot.
Wow, there's another great word. Yeah, there's two more for a fun word. I don't know if that word is real, though. I wonder if you made that
You'll never know.
Well, I could look it up.
Have to spell it right.
Google
I've
will
seen
fix
you
it for me.
spell,
I
Jonathan.
know my spelling is awful, but Google will fix it as I'm writing. Google will understand. So, but in the Christian canon,
Yeah.
Nehemiah is near the beginning, after Ezra, before Esther,
Right. We
and Job.
group it up with the books of Samuel Kings, and we put Chronicles with Samuel Kings because it's a repeat with a different theological bent. And we cram all that stuff in before we get to the writings stuff,
Right.
like Psalms and Proverbs, and then we group the books that we think are the prophetic books towards the end after that. Even though our prophets aren't the same as the Hebrew prophets in terms of the division of the Bible.
Okay. Now I
You're out
don't.
blazing again,
Yeah.
Jonathan.
No.
Successful podcast.
Well, so for those who don't know Ezra and Nehemiah, those two should usually go together.
Yeah.
And I think they're let's call them siblings. They are more or less about the reconstruction of Jerusalem. So they're post-exilic.
Yes.
And for those who don't remember their history of Israel, those who haven't read John Bright's A History of Israel. Have you read that book, Michael?
I have.
I have too.
Yeah.
We had Bill Holiday was my professor for Old Testament,
Okay.
and I think he studied with John Bright, and so that was the book we had. John Bright, it's an old book. Anyway, There's like probably two
You
of
can
them.
buy it cheap.
You could probably can. I'm not selling my version though, my copy. I'm keeping it because someday I'll read the whole thing. There are like two other listeners right now who are excited. Yay, Job Bright! And after everyone else is like, what? Why do?
They're marking it off on their bingo card. They've been waiting for the
Yeah,
John
that's
Wright
right.
square for ages.
Finally, History of Israel is mentioned. They're waiting for me to mention Pritchard.
Yeah. Whoops.
Yeah.
Whoops, you let it slip.
Oh well. So for those who don't remember, Israel, Judah, I'm going to really give a cursory history. Or maybe you should.
No, you go.
Oh, thank you.
It'll be more entertaining.
Yeah, great. They were conquered by various groups, Assyrians and Babylonians, forced to leave. Most of them. Not all of them. Most of them.
Only the important ones.
Basically, yeah. It's kind of sad. And so they had to live in exile for a certain amount of time, which I don't know off the top of my head. How
Which
long?
wasn't anything like in Romeo and Juliet, just to be clear.
Right.
Their exile was very different than Romeo's.
I didn't even know Romeo had to live in exile?
Yeah, he was exiled.
Oh.
He had to get smuggled out so that he didn't get killed.
Oh, okay.
And then he smuggled himself back in, only to find poor Juliet.
Dead. Oh, spoiler. Oh, shoot. Sorry. Sleeping?
She's not dead yet.
Yeah, I know.
Monty Python, I got it. Bingo, bingo.
And Shakespeare. If Romeo just took your basic CPR class, that story would have ended very differently. Folks, this is your PSA. Take CPR. The life you save could be your own. Actually, not at all.
At
But
least learn how to take a pulse.
yeah, please, at least that much, fool.
And if all else fails, don't kill yourself.
Yeah. Come on. Anyway, they're in exile. It's not pretty. It's not fun. Eventually, King Cyrus comes along and says, "Y'all can go home." More or less. And they go back and they find that Jerusalem has been kind of fallen into disrepair. Because the people that were forced to leave were all the ones who knew how to keep a city going.
And because everything was pretty well destroyed by the conquerors.
Right, that too. Yeah, the war thing
Yeah, the war thing,
it
little
wasn't
niggly details.
it wasn't good for anyone. So they come back and
Except the
yeah.
war profiteers, of course.
Well, they did very well.
They did, they always do.
And that's where Halliburton started. And so they come back, they find Israel and they find especially Jerusalem in disrepair, and they say, we've got to start to get it back together. So that's Ezra and Nehemiah is about trying to get it back together. And there's a little bit of different there's a little different focus in each book.
Right.
I don't know enough about the two.
Well, the short version is Ezra is mostly about rebuilding the temple,
Right.
and Nehemiah is mostly about building the wall of Jerusalem and repopulating the city.
How do they do that?
It's just sort of talks about how you're supposed or who, that it's needed to be done. There's some resettlement things that are intended, appeals to folks coming back.
Right.
None of
My
that cool stuff we're thinking about.
version has diagrams of the ways in which repopulation could happen.
Yeah.
I don't know what version you have, but this is the Hugh Hefner translation of the
The Hugh
Bible.
Hefner Illustrated Bible.
Oh my gosh. You should see Song of Solomon. It's
How many
amazing.
box tops did you have to save for that one?
It was either these or the X-ray goggles, and I just decided to go for the Bible because I'm a
Bought it.
Baptist.
It was the free gift when you bought a 10-year subscription.
Anyway, we're in Nehemiah. And wow. So that gives a bit of context. We're reading Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 8. And Michael, I'm going to ask you to read from whatever translation you have so that people get a break from the authorized and approved New Revised Standard Version, the podcast favorite.
Who did the authorization on that?
I did.
Okay.
It's the authorized by Malone, the Malone
Okay.
authorized and approved.
That's not on the title page of mine. You might want to talk to the publisher.
Oh, that's weird. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
No.
I'll get on that. But what do you have?
So I'm reading from the Tanakh, which is the Jewish Publication Society version.
And you get to say the word Tanakh.
And I did, didn't
Yeah,
I?
there we go.
You sure you don't want to do like one of the genealogy sections so we can get like tons of words?
That's why I picked this verse rather than verse 7,
Yeah.
because verse 7 just a lots of names.
So, 8.
Yeah.
They read from the scroll of the teaching of God, translating it and giving the sense so they understood the reading.
So let's give the context for this. Says everyone is gathered there. Ezra has here, my translation says the book. I'm assuming yours it says the scroll. In verse
Right.
6 or verse 5, it says, Ezra opened the book in on his left or opened the book in sight of all the people, and he was standing above them all when he did it, and he blessed the Lord, and everyone says, Amen, amen. And they're hearing from the instruction. Yours says the instruction of God, right?
The teaching of
Oh,
God.
teaching. Okay.
Yeah,
Yeah, and
it's Torah.
right. Yeah, the NRSV translates it the law, but
Right.
I think teaching is probably better. We'll give the Jews that one. They probably got that one right. I mean, this is a really key moment too, because it's kind of like it's almost a reconsecration
Yeah.
of not just the temple, but of bringing the scriptures back into their lives.
Yeah.
What I really like is that, is how it's done.
Okay.
Again, in the NRSV, it says he read from the book of the law of God with interpretation. And how was the Tanakh in verse 8?
Translating it and giving the sense.
Translating it. So, yeah, and it says, yeah, they gave, and here it says they gave the sense so that the people understood the reading.
Yeah.
Folks who, hopefully people have heard the previous episode where Michael and I went in long discourse about reading bi the Bible and such, and heard about the importance of reading in community. There is a school of thought of biblical interpretation that comes out of common sense philosophy, right? That says you don't need interpretation, you don't need explanation, just read it. And what it says is what it means, and you go with it, right? Very black and white.
Okay.
The circle is either a circle or it isn't. It's either a square or it isn't, right? This text seems to suggest otherwise.
Does it now?
I don't, well, it seems to suggest, I know,
What
you're gonna,
does it suggest?
go ahead. No, it seems to suggest that there is the text, but there needs to be some unpacking. Or at least some translating or interpreting, that it isn't what enough just to read it and say, there it is. Now go and do likewise. But what does that mean to go and do likewise? What does it mean that there it is? What does it mean that we hear these instructions? How does this apply to us? Help us out. And while this is Ezra who's doing it, and others reading it, and you're getting this teaching and such. So it's not just Ezra.
They had to take turns. It's a long section of scripture.
One of the commentaries I read said it could have taken at least 6 hours
Yeah.
to hear it, and that they stood there rapt in attention for 6 hours.
Give that a
Maybe.
try on Sunday.
I'll use this as my precedent. But that there needs to be it can't it needs to be done in community. It needs to be done with some kind of unpacking. You want to push back on that?
Well, I agree with what you're saying, but I don't necessarily think that's what this is saying.
Oh, okay, good. Then
And so,
what is this saying?
quick history of Israelite religion.
Okay.
All right, before the exile, where did they worship? They worshiped in the temple,
Right.
right? That's where their religion was supposed to be focused. That's if you wanted to pay homage to God, that's where you went,
Right.
right?
Right.
Well, in exile, the temple is destroyed. People are carted off to a foreign land hundreds of miles away. They're wrestling through much of our prophetic corpus about how do we worship God without a temple.
Right.
What emerges from exile is what we could call the synagogue tradition, which no longer requires a central temple.
Right.
allows for local gatherings and public readings and so on and so forth. What's described here in Nehemiah is very much the kind of pattern of that gathering that you would have in that synagogue context. One of the things that happened during those years of exile, too, is that a lot of Jews stopped doing the Hebrew thing.
Right, right.
And were more doing the Aramaic thing. And so when these people come back from exile, the language of the people was biblical Hebrew.
The lingua franca?
Yeah, the lingua Aramaic wasn't Hebrew, it was Aramaic.
Right.
And so what's being described here is that the readers are actually reading from the Hebrew, presumably,
mm-hmm.
the actual scrolls that they have, which on some level were probably actually written down while they were in exile. So someone is reading from the scroll, and then they're getting sort of a line-by-line translation alongside it. So this isn't them reading in the language of the people and somebody else,
right.
Like, you're saying, this is what it means. Here's how you apply it to your life.
Right, right. Okay.
This would be like in our churches, somebody standing up and reading out of the Hebrew or out of the Greek. And then somebody saying, you know, line by line, someone reads the Hebrew. Here's a rough linear translation of what that is. So that's the translating it piece, so to speak. And then there are these three words here. So they're reading it. There's the translating it. There's a giving the sense to it, and then the result is the people understood. So there seems to be the reading, there seems to be linear translation, and there seems to be somebody saying, all right, so the gist of it is here.
Good, good. So I'm not wrong.
No, not necessarily.
No.
I'm
not wrong.
Force that upon you on your own podcast.
I need to do more theology on a podcast. That's what I'm hearing. less biblical studies, more theology. No, and isn't it interesting that the NRSV that says they read from the book of the law with interpretation, the Tanakh says translated.
Yeah.
So the Tanakh is getting more accurate.
Yeah, I mean, the Jewish translators are coming out of the synagogue tradition even today.
Right, right.
So they've still, on some level, got sort of a carryover here. Of some of these kinds of practices, and they understood, I think, those historical realities better than those Christian translators of your NRSV.
I know. They're apostate.
Yeah, and you know, we didn't say this in the translation piece, but every translation has an agenda.
Yes,
it comes from a particular group of people with a particular theological bent with a particular agenda in mind.
Right.
And whether you're talking the King James Version or the NRSV or even many of the English translations before the King James Version, all of them had a particular agenda in mind.
Yeah. And that's important for people to be aware of. So one of the things, you know, when we say, like, what can we take from this, that when pastors are reading and then preaching from the text, which let's hope we still preach from the Bible and not from something else. Let's hope we still do that. You know, there's that point of where we still have to do some translating, right? Even if it's written in English, we still have to translate because these are old writings. These are really old. Older than you and me.
Right.
Which is, you know, what folks don't know is that both Michael and I are each 110. We're pretty good. We sound great, but we're both really old. But these are older. So there has to be some translating, like, here's what was going on, then here's what's going on. You know, here's how we can make some sense of it.
Yeah. Well, and we're as pastors and preachers, we are translating concepts and historical realities instead of individual words, I think.
Yeah.
More often.
Right, right. But there's a danger of over-translating or over-interpreting. And I think, you know, perhaps the difference between what the NRSV says and what the Tanakh says points to this. The NRSV says with interpretation, the Tanakh says translation. And that's a key difference.
Mm-hmm.
Even though both also say they gave the sense, which then could be the interpretation, but not so much. You know, we can overdo it and we can start to force a reading that we want people to have in our translation.
We do. You know, I did a...
Well,
did
a... maybe you do.
That was the royal we, Jonathan.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I did a project with one of our Bible study groups a couple of years back, and we read through all of the parables of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Except we read each one three times. Let's see if I can remember quite how we did this. And so the first one, I basically cut all the context out, and it was just the story.
Right.
And what we talked about was, okay, if this is just a story that you hear, if this is just a story that someone tells, what's the point?
Right.
What's the moral of this story?
Right.
And then we kind of looked and we said, okay, let's add a little context. What is the author of this gospel using the story to communicate? And then we kind of took that to say, okay, well, what can we do with it? You know,
right.
what does it mean for us?
Right, right.
It was very interesting in some of the cases that folks discovered some of those parables. When you cut all the stuff off of it and you just look at the story itself says something entirely different than what you had always thought the story meant.
Hmm.
Because what we paid more attention to was how it was used or what we had always been taught that it meant or things like that. And I think it can be that way with many texts of the Bible that, you know, you are ignorant of all of the lenses that you look through.
Right.
When you read, you might be aware of a lot of them. And I think the more of those lenses you can be aware of, the better your reading can be.
Someone had a Rylage about that.
Did they?
About lenses and narratives shaping your reality.
Could be.
It was brilliant. I don't remember who said it, but it was so good.
I'll have to look for that one.
Yeah, I'm sure it's probably on a different podcast.
Are you sure it was yours?
No. It had to be probably Phineas Mars. His Rylages are brilliant anyways. So when it comes to that reading a text and trying to offer some kind of translation for us to be aware of when our lens, we're getting into hermeneutics here. We're starting to get into Gadamer.
Well, and you can't just isolate it down, I think.
No, you can't.
I mean, I think what we understand about how the Bible came into being affects what we profess about the Bible.
Right.
And what we profess about the Bible affects how we attend to the Bible and how we understand we're capable of reading it. And sadly, there are those out there who think they're not capable of reading the Bible. And so what they do is they absorb what they've been taught.
Right, right.
Sometimes that's by pastors and sometimes that's from authors of books or relatives or whatever. And it's always sad, I think, when you confront some of that
right.
with what is very clear and obvious in the Bible, and they still aren't able to go there because it contradicts so strongly with what they had understood, with what they had taught.
Yeah. It can't be a circle. Yeah. It cannot be a circle.
Yeah, yeah.
So, folks, so pastors, be careful. I think that's what we're hearing. But also take chances and go ahead and bring people into the text. But, you know, folks, read, I would say, read all of chapter 8 of Nehemiah. Read all.
If you're going to read 8, you got to read 9 too.
Yeah.
Because it's all stuck in there and interrupt the rest of the book.
Yeah. Actually, you know, read all of Nehemiah and read Ezra too. Read Ezra and Nehemiah. They're fun. You know.
If you're going to read Ezra and Nehemiah, you might as well read 1st and 2nd Chronicles.
This is you're a real great salesman, Michael.
Yeah. Well, but, once you get invested at a certain level.
That's true. Yeah, once you've gone that far, you might as well go all the way. That's right. That's right. I mean, if you're gonna just have a sip of alcohol, you might as well drink the whole bottle, right?
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. But for this we're looking particularly at Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 8.
What?
All right, so Michael, what you into? What you into?
I know most folks on your podcast, when we get to this point, they talk about some book they're reading or something like that.
Right, something that makes them sound smart.
Well, what I've been into lately is actually photography.
With your phone?
No. Actually, film photography.
Whoa, what?
Whoa.
What? What?
Whoa.
What?
Yeah.
You're doing dairy graphs?
It's a pinhole. Actually, it's just a box with a hole in it. And no, you see, I've got a couple kids, and I realized, well, I've always kind of liked taking pictures.
He's not a creep, folks. They're all respectful.
With big telephoto lenses the street. No. I've always liked taking pictures, and I realized lately, maybe a year ago or so, that I've got lots of pictures of my kids. I mean, lots of pictures, like thousands of
Right,
pictures,
more than you need, really.
which I took quickly without paying much attention to, saved them to my hard drive, and didn't do much else with them. And when my oldest was young, we got some really great pictures, because I was using a different a real camera instead of a phone most of the time, and I was taking a bit more time because, of course, I only had one kid, so you can take a little bit more
Well, you
time.
yeah, when there's
Things
only
like
one, you can love them more.
well, I got a story about that too, but but I realized, I got like the last 2 or 3 years worth of pictures were largely crap. Very few, just I mean, literally a handful a year were worth printing out or blowing up or something like that, and that was really depressing. And so I started looking at getting a better camera, a nice digital camera, which was way out of what I can do financially. So if any of you viewers would like to sponsor me, just Jonathan can put you in touch. But anyway, I started running some numbers and everything and realized I could get a really nice film camera pretty cheap. If I shot black and white and started developing it myself, that was going to be pretty cheap. I got a neighbor who knows how to do all of that and already had the equipment for the darkroom side of things, and who could teach a bit. So started down that path, and in the last 6 months or so now, I've probably shot, I don't know, probably 15 rolls of film. 36 exposures a piece. So I mean, it's a lot of pictures, but it's not a lot of pictures.
It's not like cell
Since,
phone pictures,
right,
but
I'm not, of course, printing every picture. But I am taking some really good pictures.
Well, I imagine you have to be more selective.
Really enjoying it. It's still sometimes hard to take my time, but I realize if I don't have the time to make a good picture, I'm probably just going to pass. Or I'll pull out my cell phone and still snap it, and if it turns out great, and if it doesn't, I'm not out anything. So anyway, I've been taking pictures and reading some books and things, and talking to friends that are really into it. Of course, they're all mostly into it more from the digital side of things.
But
So there's some that cross over and some that isn't, but.
I love the discipline that film brings. And that I think originally we wouldn't have thought about it, but because the prevalence of digital pictures and that, one of the things like you can take as many as you want and then just delete the ones you don't want,
That's the attitude I had for a long time, and I realized I wasn't taking any good pictures.
And you're not careful. You're not really being aware of what you're seeing, of composition probably, of all that stuff. And then when it's a film and when like each picture matters.
Well, I've got a good friend who is, I mean, really into photography, and it's he works with digital and has, a lot more money than I even want to imagine wrapped up in it. But I mean, he's very serious about it, and actually is part of a school right now, that to advance himself some more. He's a full-time professor. This is just a really serious hobby.
Wow.
But his pictures are absolutely incredible. And he and I were talking about all of this, and he was surprised that I was shooting film. And
Right.
I mentioned how it got me to slow down and really consider
Yeah.
what I was doing. And he said that in digital, he's found a tripod does that for him.
Oh,
He
okay.
almost always shoots on a tripod because if he doesn't have a tripod, he's just snap, 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 snap.
Right.
Get out the tripod, he thinks about where does the tripod need to be to get the frame right and this and that, and he thinks about the exposure and his settings, and that slows him down. And when he's slow, he takes great pictures. And
Yeah.
so
There's probably some kind of larger life lesson with
I'm
this
sure.
that I'm not sure what it is,
Yeah.
but folks, so yeah,
Too busy to figure it out.
yeah, right. I mean, I'll think about it some other time. Yeah, right now I've got stuff to do, Michael. I've got things to
Yeah, that's right.
do. So good. So photography, especially with film.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm into a movie. I decided to not be into a book
They're
right
not
now,
into a book.
just for today.
All right.
I mean, I've got plenty, but this movie came out in 2013. It's called Broken Circle, bleh, Broken Circle Breakdown.
Okay.
It was a Belgian movie, so subtitles, unless you speak
Was
Belg,
Poirot in it?
is what?
Poirot? Was
I
Poirot in it?
don't know who that is.
You don't know who Poirot is?
Should I?
He's a main character on a murder mystery series, Agatha Christie's Poirot.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
He's
right.
Belgian.
Like Murder on the Orient Express. Yeah, no, he's not.
Oh, I
This,
like Poirot. He's
well,
got a great mustache.
he does have a great mustache. Very, very particular. No, this takes place in a modern age. And it's this couple, and they're very into bluegrass. So I like it for two things. I like the plot itself,
Yeah.
and also the music is incredible. All bluegrass, all done by the cast, which I was like, wow, that's great, because it sounds fantastic. So that's a big, the bluegrass music is a big theme. And they're really reaching at that, the darkness, the minor so sounds of bluegrass. If you were from Tennessee, you would know what I'm talking about. But since you're from
Oh, I know what you're
Indiana,
talking about.
yeah, no, you're from Indiana, you have no idea. No, right, because you spent some time in Tennessee, I guess, or your wife's from Tennessee.
There's actually a mandolin on the floor across the room.
Oh, okay. So yeah, so there's mandolin playing in this and all that stuff. So I mean, the soundtrack alone is fantastic. It really is. The movie is about a couple, them falling in love, them having a child, and then the child dies, and dealing with that grief. It's not an easy movie to watch.
You are always into the happy things.
I am into the happy things, right? I mean, it's beautiful. There's a little bit. So my critique is sometimes the guy is an atheist, and there's moments when he rails against God, right? Which I can get, but there are moments when I feel like it's contrived. Right? The arguments feel contrived, but what doesn't feel contrived is the emotionality of it. Like you can get this char this a this person is angry. This person is hurt. This person doesn't know what to do, but. The argument that he's making is something like, come on, that seems kind of weak. But the way, it's just the way they try to wrestle with this loss, and with all the losses that ensue from that. I don't want to spoil any more of the movie of that than what I just did, because there's more that happens. All right. It's very good. It's not an easy movie to watch because of all of that, but it's a beautiful movie. So, Broken Circle Breakdown, it was nominated for an Oscar in 2014 for Best Foreign Picture, I guess. I don't think it won. Probably it was too real for the
Too Belgian.
Academy. It was too Belgian for the Academy. They were like, probably because half the time they're like, wait, is Belgium a country? Where is that? I thought it was just France. I thought it was all France or Germany or Austria. I mean, does that even exist? Americans. So yeah, so folks, go take some pictures, but take your time with it. Buy some film and a camera that the film will work with. And then you can send your film to Michael and he'll develop it for you as long as it's black and white. And watch the movie.
Clean.
What?
And clean. I don't
Oh.
do those kind of pictures.
Oh. Oh.
You're telling people to take pictures and send them to me. I don't know what's going to be on that film.
I don't know. I thought you were against censorship. It's art,
In
man.
dark room, I censor.
You're right. No, Michael, thanks for being on the show. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
This is one of the few times my guest seemed or was much smarter than I was in the topic. So next time,
ooh,
I'm going to choose a different topic.
We'll have you on Biblical Interpretation Podcast later.
Yeah, thanks.
Next, it'd be like, Bible, what's that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Next time we're going to do...
about Boltman.
Yeah. Well, jeez, yeah, we won't do Boltman. Next time we'll do existentialism and the implications it has for the cross.
Yeah.
There.
I'll be here.
Yeah, right. What time's your service?
We have two services.
Whoa!
Both at weird times.
Okay.
8:10 and 10:40.
So, folks, if you're in Atchison, Kansas, go to the First Baptist Church at 8:10 or 10:40.
Yeah.
Or you could show up at 8:00 and 10:30.
You could.
And you'll be
fine.
That
would be all right.
Yeah. But don't show up at 8:30 and 10:00.
If you show up, come on in and sit down. That's all right, really.
Yeah, I've got folks showing up late all the time. As long as they get there before the offertory, it's okay. That's my rule.
You've always been about the money, Jonathan. That's why you went into this line of work.
That's right. Yeah. So, and do you have any other like self-promotion you want to push? Website or anything like that?
Not really.
Mandolin playing you do on and the side.
I occasionally try to do a blog, but I haven't done it for a long time, so I don't have anything.
All right. Well, what we'll do is next time you want to write something, send it to me. I'll put it on my blog, and I'll post you as a contributor.
And
then
people
you can write down you're a contributor
to
Theological Snob. Yeah. And all it takes is one article, and you're in. So if you're in Kansas.
All circle.
Yeah, that's it. Make sure, as long as it's decent. I have a very strict vetting process. So if you're in Kansas, go check out Michael's church, First Baptist Church, Atchison, Kansas. God, what a horrible name. Can't you live in
That's
Topeka?
Hard.
Topeka's easy.
The movie, and you'll be able to... You sing the ditty a couple of times in the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
I'm not going to. Nope, won't do it.
No.
If you're in Rhode Island, you can come to the First Baptist Church in East Greenwich at 9:30 in the morning. And come check us out. If you want to send a comment about this show or any other shows, you can do that at 12enough@gmail.com. That's written out. Come to the Facebook page, Facebook.com/12enough, where I post things happening and stuff like that. I forgot to mention that we have a live show coming up on January 23rd. It's a Saturday. And East Greenwich, Dinner and a Podcast. We're calling it Dinner and a Podcast because that's what it is. Dinner and a Podcast. I have a good line of guests for that show. 5:30. You can come to the Facebook page and find out more information about that. Michael, I hope you can make it.
I'll try.
Okay, I
gotta check the family calendar. You know how that is.
I know exactly what you mean, but I know it's not a big deal for you to get from Kansas to Rhode Island. So
I can take the Zeppelin.
Nice. That would, if you still had your handlebar mustache, it would be appropriate. But now, it's just not. Not as much, anyway. So, I think those are all the promos I needed to say. Facebook, email, and always go to iTunes. And I say this all the time. I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to mention that you should go to iTunes and rate the show because I don't think it matters. I don't think you hear me because none of you do it. None of you appreciate the time and energy that Michael and I have put into this show. So we're not going to tell you to do it. I'm not going to mention it. I'm not going to bring it up.
In other words, Jonathan could use some external affirmation. So please help him out.
I won't. I'm not going to mention that those ratings really do make a difference in our show being shared with other people. I'm not going to tell them that. I'm not going to say that if you really think this show is worthwhile, you should at least rate it, if not say some kind, put some kind of comments. I'm not going to say that. And then if you do it in Greek or Hebrew, I'll send you a t-shirt. I'm not going to mention it this time because I'm done.
You have t-shirts?
I might. All right.
If you do that and I get like a Nike shirt or something, I'm going to be peeved.
You'll get a t-shirt. You'll get a t-shirt. What do you want? All right. Thank you very much for listening. 12 and Up is a podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. Your hosts were Jonathan Malone, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of East Greenwich, Rhode Island, and Michael Strickland, the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Atchison, Kansas. The ideas, thoughts, ruminations, moments of brilliance, times of just trying to figure out where the heck they are, and corrections they give to each other, as well as really big and exciting names they mention, do not reflect their churches, do not reflect their denominations, their families, the state of Kansas. Michael does not reflect the state of Kansas. He does not. I'm leaving it just at that.
They reflect Florida.
Yeah, or do they reflect Rhode Island? These are their own ideas. This is their podcast.